Well, as promised, I am Andrew Jones, and I'll be speaking in just a few moments. Let me give you my welcome to St. Helens. It's great to see you here this evening. And it's particularly good to welcome people who've arrived since William last spoke up on the gallery. We're glad that you're here too. Throughout the week, we're going to be focusing on the biography of Jesus Christ written by a doctor called Luke. You'll find it on your tables with a green cover. It's got leaves all over it, I think. You might want to grab one at this stage of the evening. Luke tells us right at the beginning of his work that he carefully investigated the life of Jesus Christ and wrote an orderly account of it all. Sidney Jordan is going to read for us now from Luke's account of Jesus, a story that Jesus told himself. So, Sidney, where are you? Come and read for us. Good.
Thank you. If you'd like to follow, please turn to page 71 in the Luke's Gospels. Page 71, and we'll pick up this story. It's just at the bottom of the page there, under the title, The Parable of the Pharisee and the Tax Collector. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everybody else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted.
Sidney, thank you. It'd be great if you could just keep that open in front of you. I'll be referring to it as we go along this evening. Wednesday, the 24th of January 2001, was one of the most important dates in the Hindu calendar. On that day, 30 million people bathed themselves in the river Ganges as part of the 43-day Kumbh Mela festival. In total, around 65 million pilgrims made their way to India to take part in the festival. People who took the plunge during the festival did so in the belief that it would help to wash away their sins. Now, whatever your view of the Hindu practice of taking ritual baths in the Ganges, Kumbh Mela reveals a deep human instinct that all is not well with the world, and there's a need to put it and a need to put me right. It also reveals a deep human instinct that there is more to life than me and what I can see. Belief in God or the gods is taken for granted in much of the non-Western world. But even in the Western world, survey after survey reveals a majority of the population still believe in some kind of God. And the popular Western way of getting to God tends to be try your best, try really hard, and God is bound to be pleased with you. The millennium seems a long time ago now, doesn't it? But there were interminable articles and books written about the significance of the millennium. And one of the newspapers interviewed various people about faith at the turning of the millennium. They interviewed one man who was called Sam Povic. He was 37, and he was a toy company executive from New York. This is what Sam Povic said about his faith. I was brought up Protestant, and I guess that I still am. I guess it's the American religion with the founding fathers and all. It's premised on the idea that each person has one special talent. And if they utilize it, then they will be doing what they are meant to do and get rewarded for it. Anyway, I'm not like a southern Bible-bashing, believe-in-Darwin-and-you'll-go-straight-to-hell Christian. I just guess I go with the idea of some kind of God, the Ten Commandments, and that we should try and be like a bit like Jesus. Now, apologies to you if you are from the southern states. He was a Yankee, and you know what Yankees think of southerners, and vice versa. But maybe a lot of us are a bit like Sam Povic. We believe in some kind of God, the Ten Commandments, and that we should try and be a bit like Christ. Well, this evening I want us to look at that story Jesus told, which turns upside down Eastern and Western views on who gets to God and how. It's the story of the tax collector and the Pharisee, which Sydney just read for us. First of all, let's ask the question, who gets to God according to Jesus? Who gets to God according to Jesus? Well, if you'd like to look down at verse 10 of the story, Jesus describes two common characters going about their religious duties, praying at the temple. Let's do a character reference on the two of them, because their prayers tell us a lot about the kind of men they were. The Pharisee is a moral man. We've no reason to doubt that he's telling the truth in verse 11 of the story. Can you see? I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers. You could trust this man with your possessions and your spouse. If you had him as a next-door neighbor, you could sleep easy. But he's also a religious man. Can you see it in verse 12? He fasts twice a week, which was far more than Jewish religious law required, and he gave a tenth of all that he had. Again, far more than Jewish religious law required. He was a moral and religious man. Did you know that Bishopsgate, just outside the front door, is the most violent place in Britain? Did you know that? Might come as a bit of a surprise that you didn't come in here with armed guards. Now, statistically, it's the most violent place in Britain anyway. There were more attacks per head of population than anywhere else in Britain, because the area has a population of just 562. And the most recent support showed that 350 attacks per 1,000 population in the Bishopsgate area makes it the most violent place in Britain. There's no need to flee just yet. But this Pharisee would have been an asset to the neighbourhood. He would have been a good guy to have around in Bishopsgate, moral and religious. Now contrast him with a tax collector. Now, tax collectors have got a bad enough reputation in the 21st century, haven't they? Nobody likes to see a tax collector coming to knock on their door. But tax collectors in first century Palestine were infamously immoral. The Roman occupiers sold franchises for tax collection, and tax collectors were well known as traitorous collaborators who weren't afraid to exploit their fellow citizens for a few extra shekels. But they were also famously irreligious. The moment they collaborated with the Romans, they were doing the unthinkable. They were accepting another ruler of Israel apart from God. So when the tax collector calls himself a sinner in verse 13, he's using a technical term for the irreligious, those who seem to have rejected God in the way they live. So, two men, one the Pharisee, a fine, moral, religious man. The other, a tax collector, an immoral and irreligious man. Who do you think would get to God? our religious instincts, as far as we have any, tell us the Pharisee. But Jesus disorientates us completely in verse 14 when he says, look at it, if you would, I tell you that this man, the Pharisee, the tax collector, rather than the other, the Pharisee, went home justified or right with God. Isn't that an extraordinary thing for Jesus to say? The immoral and the irreligious gets to God. Now, Christians are often accused of being intolerably exclusive, because for 2,000 years they have insisted that Jesus Christ is the only way to God. And there's no point in pretending otherwise. I won't try and play that down with you this evening. Christianity is exclusive, and I'd want to argue for good reasons. Maybe you'd like to ask me about that in the questions. But as a matter of fact, I think all belief systems, whether religious or not, are exclusive. If you are a follower of Judaism, then you have to more or less follow Torah, the Jewish Bible, to get to God, depending on which branch of Judaism you are in. If you are a Muslim, then you have to follow the five pillars of wisdom to get to God. If you are a Hindu, then there are sacrifices to be made and ritual baths to be taken. If you are a Buddhist, well, depending on which Buddhists you speak to, very little may be required of you, but if you want to achieve enlightenment, then meditation is at least a good idea. And if you are a humanist, claiming no religious belief at all, then belief in God mustn't be more than a private activity. But what happens if you're not up to being religious in the ways these religions define it? What happens if you have a go, but you can't be good enough? Well, it seems that you will be excluded by Yahweh or Allah, or from Nirvana or enlightenment, or from polite liberal society. Let's stay with the polite liberal society, because I guess that's the one that most of us are most familiar with. Remember back to, well, you don't have to remember Glenn Hoddle. He's still alive and kicking and doing a good job with Southampton Football Club, apart from the odd blip against Tranmere. But do you remember a couple of years ago when Glenn Hoddle, rather crudely, I guess, said that disabled people were disabled because of the mistakes that they had made in a previous life? Now, Glenn Hoddle, albeit crudely, was stating something which, in a more refined way, is probably believed by millions of people around the world who would hold to reincarnation and karma. But suddenly, Glenn Hoddle was made persona non grata, wasn't he? And maybe rightly. But nonetheless, he was excluded from polite liberal society. All belief systems are exclusive. Now, in contrast, Jesus Christ says that there is no moral or religious qualification for getting to God. On the contrary, those who try hard, like the Pharisee, seem to be excluded, whereas the irreligious seem to be welcomed. Jesus Christ is far more inclusive than any other system I know, because through him, anyone can make it to God. There are no moral or religious tests to take before coming to God through him. Well, let's ask one other big question. How do people get to God according to Jesus? If the who is anyone can get to God, the next question is, how do people get to God according to Jesus? Well, let's start with a negative. People don't get to God by relying on their own goodness to get them through. Can you see verse 9 right at the beginning? The story is told to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else. Isn't that a critique of a very British religion? Time after time, I speak to people who say to me, I've done my best and God couldn't ask for more. Well, let's think for a moment, what kind of God would that leave us with? Usually, it leaves us with a God who is tailor-made by us, by me, to allow me to engage in all my moral indiscretions. If I have a problem with greed, then my God doesn't mind about greed. If I have a problem with anger, then my God won't mind about the odd temper tantrum. My God always draws the line at someone else's moral problem. He's a God who looks surprisingly like me. Now, who says that God is like that, apart from my need to get myself off the hook? Some of you have no doubt by now read Zadie Smith's book, White Teeth. I think it's just made its way to the top of the paperback bestsellers list. I'm about halfway through. It's a wonderful book about an intergenerational saga up in North London. But one of the central characters in the novel is a Muslim called Samad Iqbal, who early on in the book is tempted by an extramarital affair. And he tries to do deals with Allah as he struggles with temptation. And there comes a point when the narrator of the book says this: but of course he was in the wrong religion for compromises, deals, pacts, weaknesses, and can't say fairer than that. He was supporting the wrong team if it was empathy and concessions he wanted, if he wanted liberal exegesis, if he wanted to be given a break. His God was not like the charming white-bearded bungler of the Anglican, Methodist, and Catholic churches. His God was not in the business of giving people breaks. Well, I can't speak for the Methodist and Catholic churches, but it's fair comment. God in the Anglican church is very often presented as a white-bearded bungler. But Christians have always believed historically that they know exactly what God is like, and he is not a white-bearded bungler. God has come and lived amongst us in Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ didn't commit any mistakes, do any deals, or commit any sins. Jesus is perfect, and when our lives are judged against his life of perfection, we have no reason to be confident in our own righteousness. Sam Povic, the New York toy retailer, is wrong. To try and be a bit like Jesus is hopeless. When our lives are measured up against his life, then we're in trouble. Norman Mailer, one of the great American authors, wrote a book called The Fight. It was an account of the 1975 encounter between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman in Kinshasa, in what was then Zaire. And the big book opens with these words: there is always a shock in seeing him again. Not live as in television, but standing before you, looking his best. Then the world's greatest athlete is in danger of being our most beautiful man. Women draw an audible breath. Men look down. They are reminded again of their lack of worth. Ali is the Prince of Heaven. So says the silence around his body when he is luminous. Flowery stuff, isn't it? But Ali's physical perfection is nothing against Christ's moral perfection. If God is not to be a white-bearded bungler, then he must judge our imperfection, which is a result of not allowing him to rule over our lives. If he doesn't, then he's a strange, immoral God who doesn't care about injustice and rebellion. So then how can we, who can, get to God? The answer's there in verse 13. Can you see the prayer of the tax collector? God have mercy on me, a sinner. The tax collector realizes that he has nothing to bring to God. He's realistic about his position, and he knows his only hope is God being merciful to him. He just can't make it to God under his own steam. And that's one of the unique claims of Christianity. God demands nothing from us except an admission that our only hope is his mercy. I live out in the East End of London. And a few months ago, Reggie Cray was buried. And I went to the funeral. I thought it's likely to be one of the last great East End funerals, so I should catch it while I can. I stood outside English's Undertakers on Bethnal Green Road, watched them load Reggie into a glass hearse, and followed it as it was towed down Bethnal Green Road by 6 stallions. And I stood in the churchyard as the service was broadcast out to those like me who were interested watchers. And I went mainly out of professional interest. What would the minister say at the funeral of a murderer? Just in case I was ever asked to preach at one. A man who spoke I'd never heard of before, he was a man called Dr. Ken Stallard. And he said some extraordinary things. He'd written a book about young people and drug abuse some 20 years ago. Ronnie Cray had read it in Broadmoor and had summoned him to come and see him. And as he said, when Ronnie Cray summoned you, you went. And in the course of their conversation, Ronnie Cray said to him, "What does God think of me? I've killed a man." And Ken Stallard said, "I looked at him and I talked to him about Moses, one of the great Old Testament characters who had also killed a man, and how God had been merciful to Moses, had restored him, and had made him a great leader of his people." He said, "I said to Ronnie Cray that Jesus himself had said that it wasn't the healthy who needed a doctor, but the sick, and that he had come to seek and to save the lost." He said, "I said to Ronnie Cray that there was a thief crucified next to Jesus, who Jesus told was going to be with him in paradise that day." And Ronnie Cray looked at him and said, "I never knew God was like that. I never knew God was like that." And maybe that's you tonight. Maybe you never knew that God was a merciful God who didn't require you to jump through moral and religious hoops to come to him. But it makes sense, doesn't it? Am I not being arrogant to imagine that my attempts at being good will ever put me right with God? It's only his mercy which can do it, and that mercy works for us in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. If you just cast your eyes over to the bottom of page 73, you'll hear Jesus saying to his 12 disciples in verse 31, you'll see the little number 31, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled. He will be handed over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, insult him, spit on him, flog him and kill him. And on the third day, he will rise again." Jesus says that we can't live 100% life, so he lives it for us. We deserve death for our rebellion against God, but Jesus dies for us. We deserve eternal death because of our rebellion against God, but Jesus rises from the dead so that we can have eternal life. Anyone can come to God because Jesus has died and is risen again to life. So who are you with as I finish? The Pharisee, confident of your own righteousness, or the tax collector, asking God for his mercy? To help you see where you are, because it helped me to see where I was, let me tell you the end of the Cray funeral. After a while, Reggie Cray summoned Ken Stallard to see him because he realized that he was having an influence on his brother. And Ken Stallard said they became close friends over a period of 15 years, and they often had conversations about God. And he said that Reggie Cray had given him a secret which he was only to tell at his funeral. This was it. On one occasion, they were talking about God, and Ken Stallard said to him, "Reggie, are you repentant?" And Reggie said, "Of course I am. I've done terrible things. I want to turn my back on them." He said to him, "Reggie, do you want to be a Christian?" Reggie Cray said, "Yes, I would like to be a Christian." So they knelt and they prayed. And Reggie Cray asked God for mercy. And as they stood up, he said, I don't want you to tell anyone about that, because I don't want it to appear as if I am manipulating a parole board by getting religion. Now, if you like me, when I heard that, thought, no way. No way would God accept a man like Reggie Cray. Then we're with the Pharisee. But if we really understand what Jesus says about the tax collector, then we'll say, of course God can accept people like Reggie Cray. He is a God of mercy, and Reggie Cray is a man like all of us, men and women, for whom Jesus has died and has risen back to life. Well, that's all I've got to say. If you'd like to pick up some more of those things beyond the question time, then we run a short course here at St. Helens called Christianity Explored. It runs for 7 weeks. It's a series of evenings which begins with a short presentation about the Christian faith, and then there's opportunity to ask questions and discuss the issues that have been raised. Many people have found it helpful in coming to learn more about Jesus Christ and to coming to follow Jesus Christ for themselves. If it's something you'd like to do, then do fill in the form that's on your table and drop it in one of the bins as you leave. We promise you we won't give your details to anybody else, and we won't constantly send you emails with all sorts of pointless information on them. So thank you for listening. Don't be gentle in the questions. It's a great British disease, isn't it? To want to be polite and not to offend. I'm here to be offended, and so don't hold back in your questions. Thank you for listening. And break into conversations. Now, if you just want to move on your table to somewhere where you can see Andrew, we'll stand side by side. There really have been a tremendous number of questions, some really excellent questions. I want to say at this stage that we're not going to be able to answer all of them. We're going to take about 20 minutes, and I then think about 25 to something like that. 25 to 22 will call time. I do think that Christianity Explore course that Andrew mentioned is quite outstanding. Some of my family have done it and found it extraordinarily helpful. There is no way you can answer all the questions in just one session like this, and it's a kind of relaxed, round a table, rather like this evening, sort of event and occasion where you can really grill somebody over an extended period and ask the answer to some of these questions. Andrew actually has grouped them together by topic, so your question may not be asked, but something very similar to it will probably come up. Andrew. Somebody called you Andy in one of the questions. Is that a first? Andy.
I was offended. That was the first point of offence, to be honest.
I think it's rather nice. Andy, how do you combine... This is a question all about other religions. How do you combine exclusiveness and tolerance and another one? In this day and age, when there are so many other religions, how can you claim exclusivity?
It's a great question, isn't it? And one of extreme importance in the current climate, where there does seem to be so much bloodshed over religion. First of all, let me say that I am in favour of tolerance. And let me describe three different kinds of tolerance to you. First of all, I think Christianity would want to stress legal tolerance, that it should be enshrined in law that all religions have the right to practice their religion within a free society. Now, that's not assumed all around the world, but I think it is something that we should want to hold on to if we are Christians. Secondly, I would want to affirm a social tolerance as well, that we should live side by side in a situation of mutual respect and increased understanding. So the school that my children go to probably has all the major religions of the world represented there, and I'm glad that they are being educated in that kind of environment, that they learn about Islam from friends who are Muslims rather than learning about Islam as a system. I think we'd want to say under that social tolerance too that we realize that we are all human beings, that Christians would want to say that we are all human beings who are made in the image of God, and therefore we should expect to find things of beauty and of truth in other religions, and I would be keen to investigate, to discover, and to understand those things. So to encourage social tolerance. But I think there's a third area of tolerance, which is maybe where the rubber hits the road, and that's the area of intellectual tolerance. Tolerance does not mean that we say the other person is saying exactly the same thing as us, or that the other person necessarily has an equal truth claim to the things that we are claiming. I think it was Bertrand Russell, who was one of the great 20th century philosophers, who was an atheist, who said that it was a matter of simple fact that since all the major religions of the world were saying different things, they cannot all be true. So, a Christian view of God is that there is one God who is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He is three persons in one God. Now, Muslims would not be able to affirm that, nor would Jewish followers of Judaism. My understanding is that Hindus would believe in thousands, if not millions, of gods. So immediately you reach a point of contradiction, and it's a false tolerance to say that we are all saying the same thing. It's unfair to other world religions for us to say actually we're all heading in the same direction. This is why I believe that Christianity is distinctively exclusive. It's because of the uniqueness of Jesus. Jesus, like the founder of no other world religion, claims to be God, the only God. No other gods, not just the manifestation of the great oneness which is God, but he claims to be the only God. Now that is unique amongst the world religions. Secondly, he claims to be God who has come on a rescue mission, but he doesn't require us to climb a ladder to get to him. We can't do that. He comes to us in order to rescue us. Now again, as far as I'm able to tell, that is unique amongst the world religions, and says that we must treat Christianity in a different category. We may reject it, but nonetheless we have to put it in a different category. So that's the beginning of an answer to what is a good and a huge question. I'll leave it there, otherwise I'll give you another 20-minute talk.
Andrew, thank you. Does anybody want to follow up on that from the floor? We're very ready to take questions from the floor. If somebody's got a follow-up question, very happy. Yeah, at the back there.
Right.
Yeah, thank you very much. Actually, this may be your question. If I live and die as a Muslim, I'm just repeating the question for people over here. If I live and die as a Muslim, Hindu, or atheist, never seeking the mercy of the Christian God, what do you believe will happen to me when I die? And then there's a bit more, but that's basically the question.
Let me answer that with the words of Jesus, okay? It's not in Luke's Gospel. It's in another account written by the best friend of Jesus, a man called John. John recounts Jesus as saying, whoever believes in me has eternal life, but whoever does not believe in me stands condemned already. Now that's fairly exclusive language. So the issue isn't so much, am I a Muslim, am I an atheist, am I a Hindu, whatever. The issue is, how do I front up to Jesus in terms of the account that Jesus gives? Now, the account that Jesus gives of who he is and what he's come to do is that if you don't believe in him, the sharp truth is that you stand condemned by God both now and forever. Now, that's not easy, and I don't say it with any pleasure, but I suppose as a follower of Jesus, I'm compelled to say it if I believe he is who he said he was and that he's done what he said he's done. Okay, now that's a big question, and
there's probably not time for another follow-up, but if you want to grab me afterwards and talk about it, I'd be happy to.
Andrew, thank you very much. I guess the issue then becomes, what do I make of Jesus Christ?
Right.
And does he stand up? And there does happen to be an outstanding tape, free, which you can take away with you. Is it the blue one? Relativism, what's the title? Is it the something of relativism? It's red. Red tape. We have very little red tape here, but that is... The arrogance of relativism is what it's called. The arrogance of relativism that makes a truth claim. It's what Andrew was saying just in his answer there. Do take one of those away and listen to it. It's an outstanding talk.
Thursday night I'll be looking at it as well. So if you can afford to come back Thursday night, then do in a bit more detail.
Excellent. Come and join us in the gallery after supper. Be lovely. Or during supper. Now, why bother being good? There's, again, a wodge of questions here on why bother being good. If Jesus does not care about how moral one's life is, only about whether you repent, why live a good life?
Great question, isn't it? First of all, I am glad that people are good. I hope I didn't give you the impression that the worse you can be, the better, okay? That's not what I was up to. Life is tolerable because people are decent to one another, by and large, and we knock along pretty well. Christianity does not believe that people who are not Christians are somehow moral monsters. As I said, we have a strong belief that people are made by God like him, albeit that all of us have turned our back on God, and that has consequences for the way the world is. The point I suppose I was trying to make is that our goodness, as much as I'd want to encourage it, is never good enough to get us to God. If the standard is 100%, then even if we hit 99%, then that won't be good enough to get us to God. Now, I don't know where you rank yourself on the moral ladder, whether you're kind of way at the bottom with the Hitlers of this world, if you believe Hitler was at the bottom, or whereas you're near the top with the Mother Teresa's of this world. Most of us would probably stick ourselves somewhere in the middle on a good day, wouldn't we? We don't kick the cat too often. But if God's standard is 100%, then however good we are, we will never ever attain that. And so we have a big problem, which is why Jesus came to rescue us and to sort out the problem. Now, the flip side of that is that whilst there is no moral requirement to come to God, because we could never meet it, once we do say, yes, I am trusting Jesus, I believe that when he died in my place, he took the punishment that my moral failure and rebellion deserves, when we come to that point of asking God for his mercy, then we're set free to begin to live as he intended us to live. So Christians do strive to be good, not perfect, because we'll never be that. But we are striving to be like Jesus with his help. And again, that's a remarkable thing about Christianity, is that it says God comes and takes up residence in a person's life and enables them to be better than they were. Not perfect, but better than they were. Okay? Now again, that may come across as a bit smug, so come back to me if you want to.
Can I ask you a follow-up, which is one of the questions here? If the only criteria for entry into heaven is lack of smugness, what if you think, like the Pharisee, that you've done all the right things to get there?
Right. Well, again, I suppose we're brought back to, what does Jesus say is the right thing to get there? Okay. Now, that begs all sorts of questions about why should we believe anything that Jesus says, and we may come back, or at least the accounts of what Jesus says, and we may have time to deal with that question in a moment. But if Jesus says the one thing that is necessary to get to God is to ask him for mercy, and if you're around tomorrow night to discover that he says, follow me, then in a sense, all the good things that we accumulate are irrelevant. They're not actually what's required. It's like going to Smith's with a $10 bill and trying to buy a newspaper. It just won't work down in Leadenhall Market. You've got the wrong coinage to get what you need. Jesus says it's not goodness that you need. It's a trust in him that you need and in his death and resurrection to get to God.
Thank you. Does anyone want to come back on this whole area of being good, morality, that sort of area? the follow-up. Yeah.
I mean, it begs the question as who establishes what is for the best of a society and what promotes the greatest happiness. I think those are two questions you have to ask. What, you need a moral framework before you can even ask that question. I think then it begs the question, well, actually, is happiness the greatest human goal? There are enormous numbers of people who have suffered the most awful things, which we would say could never ever lead to happiness, but if you speak to them, they will say, I would never have been without it. This has been one of the most profound experiences of my life. So I suppose the question begs a lot of others. Come back to me at the end.
Great, thank you very much. And just one other, because I think this is quite a good one, that puts the Christian in the dock a bit. If Christianity does not demand high moral standards, why has Christianity often been so intolerant in the past?
I think there are probably about 3,000 questions in that one, aren't there? Let's deal with the first half of the question, if Christianity doesn't demand high moral standards. Christianity demands high moral standards once you're in, okay? Christianity doesn't demand high moral standards to get to God. I'll keep saying it, okay? It doesn't demand high moral standards to get to God. But once you become a follower of Jesus, Jesus says that there is a certain way that he wants us to live. And that's why we gather together, part of the reason why we get together week by week. Christians don't behave as lone rangers. They meet here on a Sunday and they meet in small groups to keep each other going, to keep following Jesus and to keep striving to be like him. The back end of the question, which was, why has Christianity been so intolerant? Hands up that there have been some atrocious things in the history of the world which have been committed by Christians in the name of Christ. And I suppose all that I can say is that they are terrible. I don't think Jesus would affirm them, and I don't wish to affirm them either. But I think sometimes when that has happened, it's Christians who have missed the point that we've been trying to drive home tonight and have been saying to other people, you need to clean your act up before you can come to God. And what's more, we're going to help you clean your act up. And sometimes we'll do that through violence, which is unacceptable, and it misses the point Jesus is making. Mm. Okay?
Andrew, thank you. Now, look, there are two groups of questions here. I want to be disciplined about this. One on the beginning of life, one on the end of life. If the only prerequisite of getting to God is belief in God, what is the position of a child that is born so handicapped, mentally handicapped, that it can't comprehend or believe in God? Is that child precluded from getting to God?
Okay, just, I don't want to be pedantic, but let me just clarify it. The prerequisite for getting to God is a trust and a belief in Jesus to get us to God, rather than just the general God. Let me address the question, because it's a question that may very possibly have a whole life of pain behind it. So I don't want to give you a simplistic answer, and I'm not sure that I've got a complete answer for you anyway. I suppose that the God who Jesus reveals in the story of the tax collector and the Pharisee is a merciful God. He's not a God who is waiting there to hammer people because he's got a short fuse. Now, I suppose because I believe God is a merciful and a gracious and a loving God, I'm prepared to place children who die in this situation into his hands and to trust that he'll do the right thing. I wouldn't want to build too much on it, but there is there's an extraordinary story in the Old Testament, the first part of the Bible, where God's people grumble at him. He's done great things for them, and they just don't want anything to do with him. And so he comes and he judges them. But interestingly, everybody under 21 is exempt from the judgment of God in that period. Now that seems to say something, I'm not sure what, and I don't want to push it too hard, but it does seem to say something about God's attitude to younger people. And I suppose I would want to say that God is a God of mercy towards people who die before an age of responsibility before him. Okay?
Andrew, thank you. And now this, I think this question puts it most clearly. On the basis of what was said, is that not an incentive to live flagrantly till we're about to die? And this is the question everyone was wanting to ask, isn't it? And then repent.
Do a Ronnie and Reggie.
Yeah.
Really? That's what we're asking. Well, it's not. It's not, for at least two reasons. Here they are. First reason is that if Jesus is right, if we are made by God to know God through him, then it would be a terrible waste of a life to not be doing what we should be doing. It would be missing out on the most profound relationship that anybody can have, to know the God of the universe, the God who has made us, the God who has died for us in Jesus Christ. That's the first reason. The second reason is that it assumes that you know when and how you will die. Now, most of us, I'd imagine all of us, don't have a clue how and when we would die. And we're probably grateful that we don't, because it may be too terrible to even think about. But it could be that we die tonight. It could be that we die in 30 years. And again, the teaching of Jesus is that there is no second chance. That once we die, we either face God with a smile on our face because we have trusted him and know him as our Father and our Maker, or we face God as our judge, who will separate us from himself forever. So I suppose if you reach a point where you are convinced that it's only through Jesus that you would come to know God, and that's what you were made to be, then why on earth wait until the end of your life and take that risk? Okay? Anything to add?
I think my experience is people get very practiced at rejecting God. And, you know, actually, if we go on and on and on and on rejecting God, it becomes we can get very hardened towards God. It's my experience of meeting older people who've gone on and on rejecting him. They find it very hard to turn back. These are all about the historicity of the Gospels. Ever heard of Chinese whispers? Why should I believe in what an old book says? Aren't there inconsistencies? How can we believe the truth? And how can we be sure that what Jesus has to say is any more validity or authority than the leaders of other religions? So largely about the historicity.
Lots of things we could say. Let's start with that back one. If Jesus is who he says he was, the one and only true God who has appeared as a human being on earth, then you can trust anything he says 100%. Okay, that's why we stake our lives on him, is because of that claim. Let's look at the documents themselves. Maybe just as an example, if we go back to the beginning of Luke's Gospel, if you've still got it on your table, you might like to open it at page 7. Don't worry if you don't want to, I'll read it to you anyway. This is the way Luke begins his Gospel. Sometimes we imagine that these people were first century idiots, really, who could barely string a sentence together. Luke, we know, was a doctor, not with the same degree of scientific precision that we know now, but he was certainly an intelligent man who wasn't open to believing fairy tales when he knew they were fairy tales. This is the way he begins his Gospel. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. So from the very earliest days, people were writing histories of Jesus. How? Verse 2, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. The people who had been with Jesus, men like John, his best friend, who had seen the things he'd done, who had heard the things he'd said, were making sure that it was committed to writing. A rabbinical form of teaching would have meant that the followers of Jesus would have memorized the things that he said. So when you spoke to them, they would have pretty much given you a verbatim account of his teaching. Those men and women were active in telling others. They were credible sources. When people like Luke wrote down what they'd been told, if they'd got it wrong, people would have known soon enough within the generation after the life of Jesus. How does Luke describe his own historical method? Verse 3, therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you. Luke is setting himself up as a careful historian. He's inviting criticism. He's inviting the people who knew about Jesus to give their opinion as to whether or not this is what happened and what was said. So I think the sources of these manuscripts we can trust. If we don't trust these, then we can't trust the sources of any ancient manuscript. Now, the question then becomes, well, is this the manuscript that Luke wrote? Is any of the New Testament the manuscript that was written? Now, I know I've heard William on this before. William, tell us why we can trust these manuscripts.
It's like being reeled out for a party trick, isn't it? the manuscripts were translated very quickly into all sorts of different languages because there was a huge explosion of the Christian faith out from first century Palestine, Syriac, Aramaic, Greek, and later Latin. And they went through, all sorts of different translation routes. Now, we don't have documents, so I suppose from about the second century, we've got bits of documents and some complete documents of the different Gospels in different languages. But we have a huge number of documents from a few centuries later than that that have gone through different translation routes. Now, if I sent Luke's Gospel in one translation route, let's say Syriac, from Fiona round that way, and in another translation, say Greek, from this chap here who I don't know, round that way, and just in the two, we met back in the middle, and they actually said the same thing, you would know that what had gone out and come back was the same as what started. Okay, that's just straight logic, isn't it? Now, that is the case. I mean, you can see as you read through your own Luke's account that there are one or two slight differences, but nothing of substance, nothing of real substance when it comes to the truth, the doctrine, the real things that happened. They're one or two small changes. And they went through the more than just two translation routes. They went through several different translation routes, and you can bring them all back together in the 4th, 5th century, whatever, and you begin to see that they are saying the same thing. And Andrew will give you a copy of his Greek New Testament, and at the back of the Greek New Testament it lists all the alternative readings. And they are small. I mean, they're not big issues. They're tiny little things.
Just one last point on this, and this may not be of interest to many at all, but if you are somebody who's been exposed to literary theory and to philosophical issues about what is meaning about in any text at all, and isn't meaning all in the reader, and the text is fairly bereft of any meaning, then come and talk to me afterwards and we'll thrash it through. It's probably not an issue that's of wide interest to everybody, so we won't talk about it now. But I am aware of those issues, and I'm happy to talk to you about them if you've got questions like that. Okay?
Okay, last one, Andrew, very quickly. How can I know I've been... Andy, how can I know I've been forgiven? How can I know I've been forgiven is the last question.
My wife calls me Drew. That's kind of... that's the only affectionate name that I answer to. How can I know that I've been forgiven? I think there are two parts to how can I know that I've been forgiven. The first part is an objective thing, that God has acted in history so that you can be forgiven. That the death of Jesus Christ was not an accident of history. It wasn't that he went up to Jerusalem and got caught out in a political plot. I think we've seen from Luke 18 tonight that Jesus knew what he was going up to do. He expected to die, and he willingly allowed himself to be killed. Because as he said to his disciples the night before he died, as he poured out wine with them, this is my blood, anticipating his death in the next few days, this is my blood which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. So our assurance that we have been forgiven is located 2,000 years ago outside the walls of Jerusalem in a man who dies on a cross, who is God and claims to be dying for us and indeed for the sins of the whole world. So that's the first sort of strand of assurance as to whether or not we've been forgiven. The second strand is the subjective strand, because that death of Jesus doesn't operate for us independently of us. The death of Jesus operates for us as we come to acknowledge that Jesus is who he said he was, and that Jesus in dying has died my death and has taken my punishment from God. So that's the extraordinary thing about Christianity, that this is God punishing God because he loves his creatures so much and he wants them to know him. So how do I relate to that? Have I trusted that when Jesus Christ died, he died for me? And as I trust that he has done that for me, have I turned away from a life which is going in my direction, and have I turned to live a life which is going in God's direction? Those are the two things that the Bible calls faith and repentance, and that they're at the heart of being sure that Jesus died for me. Okay? Thanks for listening, and thanks for lots of great questions.